Welcome to Your Right to Speak's discussion on social justice and advocacy. This is episode 26. I'm your host, Salvatore. Jenna, unfortunately, will not be with us today. Hopefully, we can have her back. I know she's been absent in the last couple of episodes. Today's episode, we'll be talking about disability and CYC practice. And I'm very excited for this episode because a large amount of my research and experience has been around this topic, so I'm ready to dive into it. We'll be talking with Shay Ehrlich, who is in her last couple of days in the Ryerson Child and Youth Care Masters, which is very exciting. You're almost done. Shay, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Shay. I am, as Salvatore said, I'm finishing up my master's degree at Ryerson right now in the Masters of Child and Youth Care program, which is very exciting. My research interests have been primarily focused on disability and child and youth care, and also most recently on social circus and child and youth care. So I'm actually writing my major research project on understanding the use of social circus as child and youth care practice, which is very exciting since using circus as part of our work is not something that happens very often in the field of child and youth care.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of who I am, I'm also multiply disabled and genderqueer, so that really influences my view on pretty much everything.
Exciting.
Yeah.
So, okay, we're just going to dive right into it. So as you've said, you've done a lot of your research, from what I understand, also on deafness and CYC practice.
Yep.
So can you please just, I guess, generally tell the listeners what you found in your work? Have there been any challenges or gaps that have come up?
Absolutely. So I'm hard of hearing, and so that really influenced my work. I came into the Child and Youth Care program as an undergraduate student, really interested in how this would work in the deaf community. The deaf community, sort of globally, is one of the most underserved populations, and because there's a communication barrier when a deaf person is communicating using sign language, that means that often they're not thought about in services. They become a little bit invisible. We don't see them accessing our services because our services aren't accessible, and then because we're not seeing them there, we don't think about making our services accessible. And so it becomes sort of this feedback loop of that services continue to be accessible and deaf people continue to not access them. And so there's a huge gap there. And then on top of that, there's also a significant cultural difference between the deaf community and the hearing community. And so it's not just enough to make things accessible by having services being able to be provided in ASL. It's also about understanding the cultural context of the young people who we're working with in our field, because otherwise, as like a really brief example, I was looking at some intake forms for walk-in mental health counseling in the last few weeks, and one of the questions on their forms is, do you see or hear things that other people don't see or hear? And I had to say, don't be surprised if every deaf person who walks in the door checks those off, because, for example, I wear hearing aids, and my hearing aids beep in my ears to tell me different things if I'm changing the program, or if I'm or if the battery's going low, or if I have it connected to my phone, it'll tell me the caller ID, and nobody else can hear those things, but I hear them and they're in my ears. And so if I didn't understand that that was a question that was screening for, you know, the potential for psychosis, I might check that off, because it's true. In my experience, I hear things that other people don't hear. And so understanding things like that, or understanding, you know, the value of signed communication versus even having written communication back and forth. Written communication might be accessible, but it might not be culturally appropriate for the young person
right.
who we're working with. So there's so many gaps and challenges in working with this community, and it's one that I'm really passionate about seeing us do better with.
I do agree. I have found in my research that there's certain, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I know one of the cultural piece is not labeling deafness as a disability for mm-hmm. some people. So
right.
I don't want to
conflate the two.
Yes. But I've noticed that, you know, like deafness is one piece that's often forgotten. And my work within the disability community, there's other disabilities that I think are often forgotten as well. Or I think there's this idea that we have those accommodations already set in place for certain I guess, challenges or unique needs.
Right.
And so those communities are just left out. So, you know, I'm someone who has a learning disability, and often, you know, I just feel like there's those cookie cutter accommodations,
Absolutely.
Right? And my understanding, please correct me if I'm wrong, is it's kind of similar within the deafness community as well. It's more than a hearing aid or some sort of device assistance or sign language. It goes beyond that.
Absolutely. It's a really broad range of accommodations. It can mean things like, for example, if I was sitting with my back to a door and someone walked in, I might not hear that someone walked in until they spoke, and that might startle me. And so someone might, if someone can see the door and I can't, they might need to give me a heads up and say, Shay, you know, so-and-so just came through the door, or I might notice that they looked up. It's really a different way of processing information and understanding the world. It's a different orientation to the world. And so the ways that we accommodate that are really different. And within the deaf community, there's a huge amount of variation. For example, I identify as hard of hearing. I can hear well enough to have, you know, this conversation that we're having one-on-one without having an interpreter. But when I'm in school, I use an interpreter to handle, you know, the 30 people that are in a classroom. And it depends. For other people, that might not be possible. Some people are okay with lip reading. Some people are terrible with lip reading. And some people, you know, even with the use of assistive devices, can't hear anything. Some people with assistive devices have, you know, fairly close to normal hearing. But once you take off the assistive devices, then, like, that's it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and then if they break or something goes wrong with them, like, technology is fantastic and wonderful so long as it's working. And unfortunately, with technology like hearing aids, I know that I've certainly had pairs of hearing aids that have spent more time getting fixed than actually being functional. So yeah. Technology is great, but it also is limiting. And when you rely on it for, you know, your, what we call, you know, activities of daily living, it can be really frustrating if you don't have other ways of getting by in the world.
I think it's even a question of, so I worked at the Provincial Advocate's Office as a youth amplifier, and I worked on the We Have Something to Say project.
Right.
And one of the big things that I found so significant that came from that report was that accommodation looks different to everyone.
Absolutely.
And I really think as practitioners or anyone working with children and youth that we need to really think of what accommodation looks like in the individual.
Absolutely.
Right? Because it's not, like I said, those cookie cutter accommodate, it's not that, it's beyond that, and those help to a certain extent, but it's kind of redefining what accommodations is.
Exactly, and within the deaf community especially, the incidence rate of additional disabilities is somewhere around 30 to 40%, so you might have a deaf young person who is deaf and blind, which is a fairly common combination, or deaf and has learning disabilities, or is deaf and is on the autism spectrum. And so what accommodations, you know, especially if you're looking at deaf and autistic, the combination of accommodations is going to look very different than just one or just the other.
I know we got a little bit off, still on topic, but a bit off. My next, I guess, thing that I would like to talk about and ask you is often, you know, I found in my work with young people with disabilities or who need different types of accommodations, their voices are often left out of that conversation and, I guess, decision-making processes. And it's often seen as that they're not capable to handle those types of adult conversations, if we can label it as that. Do you find this to be true? And if so, what are some ways that CYC practitioners or people who work with young people can better address this?
I think that there's two sides to it. As being disabled myself, I know that sometimes it gets really frustrating to have that conversation with, you know, all of the spaces that I live my life in. Like, I might find that, you know, I've had that conversation with every single professor that I've had at school, and then I have to have that conversation with my disability counselor at school, and then if I want to go to an event, you know, let's say I want to go to a student union event, then I have to have that conversation with the student union event. And so to some degree, I think that there's more that we can do as practitioners to be proactive, to think about the young people who are in our spaces and what accommodations need to be there. so that young people aren't having to make that request again and again and again, because that gets exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's that side of it, that when we have an awareness that there's someone in that space who uses those things, that should be at the forefront of our planning whenever we're planning something. It irks me to no end when it's, you know, a group that I've been involved with for a while, and then they're like, oh, we want to have this event, and then it's like, I have to be at them. Well, did you book sign language interpreters? Did you do that? Because they forget, because it's not part of their normal. Whereas I think that if we approached it with, like, accessibility planning needs to be at the center of everything that we do, that takes away a lot of the work for individuals. So that's the one side of it. The other side of it is that I do think that young people are often not talked to about their needs. I think that especially when it comes to disabilities, we see, you know, LD assessment, a learning disability assessment, or we see accommodation paperwork come in, or this diagnosis or that diagnosis, and then we automatically get a picture in our heads of what's going to work for this young person, so oftentimes before we've even met them. And I think that we need to do a better job of interrogating with young people, sitting down with them and in conversation with them, saying, what does this mean for you? What does that look like? How can we make things better for you here so that this meets your needs? And that should be a conversation that we're having with all young people, regardless of whether they're disabled
for sure.
or not. How can this program that you're now involved with better meet your needs? And what can we do to best support you in the ways that you learn best, in the ways that you interact best, in the ways that are, you know, going to avoid, you know, triggering you with something that we didn't necessarily have to. You know, if you hate red food, let's make sure that there's non-red mm-hmm. food options, and then we can avoid, you know, that
right.
meltdown 3 weeks from now when that's what's for dinner.
Right. I think it's, I mean, you're preaching to the choir here. I totally agree with everything that you're saying. And, you know, I can see some of the listeners thinking, oh, that's such a revolutionary idea. How do we, you know, get to that point? How do we do that? And, you know, for me, really, you know, young people want to be involved, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
And when I say young people, I just want to make clear, because I often say this, it's children and youth. I label it as both, because mm-hmm. to me, they're children or people too. It doesn't just mean youth. but now I lost my train of thought. But yeah, I mean, for some people, I can see them thinking, you know, who've been in the field for so long, oh, it's so revolutionary, or how do we get past the policy, or, you know, we can't possibly logistically ask every young person part of a program on how to meet their needs.
Well, I think that, especially in residential care, we're obligated to provide mm-hmm. culturally sensitive
right.
approaches, and that's, you know, mandated by law, it's mandated by best practice standards, and I don't see disability being separate from that. Particularly when we're talking about disabilities that do have a significant cultural component, like there is such a thing as blind culture, there is such a thing as deaf culture. And so particularly in these cultures, but understanding disability as a cultural difference even more broadly, I think that it fits very nicely into programs that have already given thought about how we support young people's religious and spiritual beliefs, how we support young people's ethnicities and racial backgrounds, and connecting them with those communities. There's not a big difference between putting those ideas in a plan of care and then putting ideas around disability into a plan of care in a really similar way. And I feel like that engages with young people on a much more peer-to-peer participatory level, where we're asking them about how we can best include them, how we can best mm-hmm. respect their cultural ways of being in this world that isn't as defined by these typical things that we think of when we think of culture.
I think in essence what you're kind of saying is building off of what's already existing to make the systems better,
mm-hmm.
which completely makes sense to me. But I don't know. I can see, you know, those rigid CYC practitioners, you know. I think you know who I'm talking about.
But we don't need to hate on them, right?
No,
like,
no.
I think that there's space to say, I think what it's important to say is that it doesn't have to be another onerous piece of mm-hmm. this work. That I think that it's really important to point out that these are conversations that we should already be having with young people
right.
fairly regularly, and that it doesn't take that much more to be like, hey, I was planning on, you know, doing this activity, you know, tomorrow, where we're going to put up a whole bunch of chart paper up around the room and fill out things. Would it be helpful if when we do that, I partner you up with someone who I know likes to write, so that you don't have to write in front of everyone and become anxious that you might make spelling mistakes up in front where
right.
everyone can see it? it's just a part of thinking through as we're planning, as we're doing our activity planning, as we're going about our day to day. It's just like, it becomes a natural way of checking in with people. And I think that it becomes a tool for relationship building too, because it builds in safety. Oh, I know that you're not going to put me on the spot in something that I can't do because of my disability. It builds trust in the relationship. I know that you're considering my needs, that I feel cared about because you're thinking about me when we're thinking through these things. So I think that it just requires a shift in terms of how we as practitioners perceive what we're doing, that it doesn't just become this like procedural step that's a barrier. It becomes an opportunity to further facilitate these really fantastic relationships right. with young people, which is something that regardless of whether you've been around for 50 years or whether you just graduated, is something that we should all want to be doing.
For sure. You know, it reminds me a bit of what you're talking about, and I'm sure you've learned this, cultural humility. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's... And I've explained to the listeners, so we don't have to get into it. But it very what you're saying for me very much aligns with that approach. You know, it's really, you know, understanding individually where the young person's at really, but also at the same time for the practitioner to understand or be self-aware enough to know that they may not know all the accommodations possible, right? And in all honesty, sometimes it is hard. I mean, I think we've been trained to just think of disability as the physical piece.
Absolutely. 100% I would agree with that.
Right. So, I mean, it's more than, you know, having elevators in a building, right? There's those, you know, invisible disabilities or invisible pieces that I think we often don't consider. Often I'd love to hear this opinion on it is in CYC training, I can't speak about the other social services, but I know in CYC training, I have talked with a whole bunch of students and the one thing that they say is lacking in our training is the disability angle. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, when we have our class on abuse and addictions and all those pieces, we talk in very general terms. And then as, you know, future practitioners, we're okay, well now either you change your approach to better meet those needs or you do the same thing, right? And I often think that we need more, I guess, training or more of that piece in our education.
So I would want to trouble that a little bit.
Yeah,
because
for sure.
I think that there's a danger in doing that. And the danger that I see in doing that is creating a position where practitioners feel like they're the expert in creating
right.
accommodations. And so going back to what you just said a minute ago, I think that my suggestion of talking about it from a cultural place and talking about it from like a collaborative place with young people gets around the place where practitioners have to feel like they know how to accommodate every disability. And it takes away some of the uncertainty and some of the fear of that, right? Like, I don't have to know. If I know that my practice is that I'm going to check in with people and build relationships that are centered around checking in with people and negotiating things in the moment, then I don't have to worry about, you know, if this activity that I'm planning is going to be accessible based on, you know, something that I might not be able to anticipate, because I know that I've built up enough relational trust with young people that if something isn't working, they're going to feel safe to be like, hey, you know, writing like this in front of everyone, I'm not so okay with that. Would you be okay if I, you know, bring my laptop downstairs and can type it out, because then I can use spell check and then nobody has to see, you know, the horrible way that I spell things.
Right.
Or would you be okay with sitting next to me and helping me with the spelling if we're going to write it out? And young people often know what they need better than we do and have all of the creative solutions. And so I think that we do need to talk about disability more. We need to be talking about the social model of disability. We need to be talking about disability as something that's integrated into our practice. But I do think that there's a significant danger in separating it out. Because what I found is that when we separate it out, the only place that I ever remember hearing about disability in my education is talking about autism and talking mm-hmm. about developmental services. And so disability became like condensed way down into only talking about young people with developmental disabilities.
Right.
And I do truly believe that if we're engaging in good relational child and youth care practices, we're going to be accommodating disability just as a natural consequence mm-hmm. of engaging in a relational experience with the young people who we're working with and checking in with them and saying, how is this for you? How are you interpreting the meaning of this? How is this connected to your other experiences? Is this better, the same, worse? What is it reminding you of? And being really yeah. curious about that experience for the young person.
In a sense, it kind of talks about, I guess, on a broader level, you're saying is having, whether the young person has a disability or not, is creating that safe space for them and that trusting relationship that if they need anything, they're able to come to you as a practitioner to get their needs met.
Absolutely.
I agree 100%.
And so I think that when we're having conversations with disability and child and youth care practice, that always needs to come with the question of, why are we doing this differently with this young person? Are we doing it differently because this is something that they need, or are we doing it differently because they're disabled? Right. And I think that that's really the crucial question. And if the answer is that it's because they're disabled, then we need to really interrogate, is that an accommodation and therefore a need, or is that our perception mm-hmm. of what that disability means for that young person?
So happy you said that. I'm fine to end the episode here. I just want to change the conversation just a little bit, and I want to talk about CYC practitioners who have a disability. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know how to ask this question, but I'm just going to go for it, and you can tackle it if you want.
Sure.
Can you explain how having, I guess, a disability could impact, so a practitioner having a disability could impact the relationship between a young person and the practitioner?
Yeah. What I think really tends to happen when we have practitioners who have a disability, because we have so much of a focus on self and self and relationship mm-hmm. in our field, in some ways it's a little bit different from other fields, because whoever you are and yourself is, that's okay. You're bringing yourself in the door, and if you're disabled, that includes your disability. But on the other hand, a lot of our literature about self and relationships talks about, we have to make sure that how we're using ourself in relationship is to meet the needs of the young people and not to meet our own needs. And where I see that conflicting a little bit with disabled practitioners, and even with marginalized practitioners mm-hmm. more generally, is that there are needs that we have that pertain to our safety and our integrity and our well-being that then impacts our ability to be in relationship with young people, that we need to figure out how we can advocate for in ways that support the young person and in ways that model things for the young person. So what I've been thinking about lately is those moments where disability becomes visible in the room. So for example, if I was working with a young person and I was having a lot of trouble understanding them, I would have to say, you know, hey, listen, I really want to hear what you're saying. Can we move to another room so that I can hear you? Or, you know what, maybe we need to get an ASL interpreter in here for us to have this conversation, because I really respect and understand, you know, that what you're trying to say is really important, and I want to make sure that I get as much of it as possible. But we need to do this so that we can do that. And I think that in those moments, what's really important is that we're modeling for young people how to advocate for their own needs.
Right.
And we're still making it about their needs. It's still, I want to hear what you have to say, but this is what I need for us to be able to do this. Or I'm diabetic, so if my blood sugar goes low while I'm in the middle of something, it doesn't matter what I'm in the middle of. If I don't eat, I'm going to pass mm-hmm. out. So I would need to be able to advocate in that moment to the young person to say, hey, listen, we need to stop this activity for a second. I need to go get some juice. Why don't we go take a snack break together and we'll come back to this in 15 minutes. And to be able to model, hey, look, in this moment, I need to take care of myself to be able to be here to support you. Let's do this together. It's still going to be relational. We're not completely abandoning what we're doing, but we're going to take this minute. We're going to refocus, regroup, and then come back. And then being consistent in that. And I think that there's a lot of lessons that can be learned mm-hmm. through those moments. And I think that it just requires a reframing of the fact that, yeah, sometimes ourselves and our stuff comes up in these relationships, and that's okay. We don't have to be, you know, robot practitioner who has, you know, no feelings, needs, mm-hmm. emotions, etc. You know, I identify as genderqueer. If people mess up my pronouns, I want to feel empowered in a child and youth care relationship to say, hey, listen, just to remind you, you know, my pronouns are they and them. And I don't want to have to feel like I'm a bad practitioner for taking a moment to, like, negotiate what I need right. for my own safety in that relationship.
And I think, I mean, there's two big things that I think you said. One was the modeling, and the other part was allowing kind of ourselves as practitioners to be in that relationship with the young person. And it's not being that robot. I often think, you know, a lot of the work that we do as practitioners is in the gray. Mm-hmm. And I understand, you know, we need to have those boundaries up. But a lot of work, you know, how can you build a relationship with someone if you can't share a little bit of yourself within that relationship?
Exactly. And I think that that's sort of the key piece is that, you know, I'm not trying to say that, like, I'm, you know, if a young person uses the wrong pronouns for me, I'm going to be selective about the moment. If they're bawling and they're upset right. about something, I'm not going to be like, hey, you have to start crying because you got my pronouns wrong. Like, that's ridiculous.
Yes.
Like, you know, okay, fine, I'm going to let it go in this moment, but I'll make a mental note that, you know, next time when it's a calm moment, I'll just be like, hey, just to remind you, these are the pronouns right. that I use. And so it's about knowing that my needs don't always come first unless it is, of course, right. a matter of safety or a matter of, you know, being able to support that young person to the best of my ability, but that they get to be there. And it doesn't mean that I'm going to give the, you know, the young person my full history of this is every time someone's used the wrong pronoun for me and how it's made me feel and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
They don't need that, but they need to know, you know, that I'm a person too, that I'm a complicated person, that there's lots of layers to what's
right.
going on with me. And I think that I can model how, you know, and I think that that's a strength as a practitioner, that I can model how you can be all of those things and negotiate the multiple roles that we have in every relationship simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And how we can negotiate navigating, you know, intersectional marginalized identities simultaneously while still negotiating how power works between the two
right.
of us.
I think, and we're almost running out of time, and I just want to get to one other point from what you said, and then I'm going to ask my trademark question.
All right.
I think, you know, what you also said was the modeling piece, and I would just want to stress that a lot because I know within the disability community, there is young people with disabilities do not always have the skills of self-advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think modeling that piece is so, so important. That's almost come up in every conversation that I've had on disability and young people and adults who, you know, recognize that they didn't have those skills and how it impacted their lives until they were able to gain them. So I just want to stress that because it is such, for me, an important piece.
Yeah. And young people might not be able to do it for themselves at first, and they might need to see
right.
other people advocating for those needs in a relational way, in relationships. I think that there's, you know, so much value to learning how to do that in a way that's not confrontational and affirms the relationships
mm-hmm.
that we have with each other. Because I find, you know, if you go up to someone and be like, you didn't meet my accommodations, this didn't work, you know, that's a hard play. That's a hard stance
right.
to negotiate how you're going to move forward from that. If you go like, hey, like, I really appreciate that you tried and did this, but, you know, maybe next time could we try it this way?
Mm-hmm.
That's a much softer way that gets a different approach. And if we can't figure out how to negotiate that, you know, as adults, how can we expect young people? Of course, the young person's going to come in and be like, this didn't work. This you didn't accommodate me because they haven't seen any other way
right.
that's actually
yeah.
effective.
So I hate to cut this conversation short because I can talk for hours about this stuff. But I'm going to ask you the question that everyone knows is coming. What does advocacy mean to you?
I've been thinking a lot about it because I didn't want to give a stock answer. And I've recently come to recognize in myself that one of the skills that I have is a little bit as a translator in terms of being able to take things from other places and see how they apply in different places and you know, like even doing this work within the deaf community, what does child and youth care look like in the deaf community? That means that I have to translate between what child and youth care says and translate between what the deaf community says and come up with something that makes sense to both pieces. And so for me, advocacy is using that skill as a translator to be able to hear what a young person's saying and then be able to take that back to other professionals or other systems that need to be able to hear what the young person's saying. And I'm very fortunate in that I am capable of picking up on the lingo of how to talk about things in different disciplines very quickly. So I find that oftentimes if I'm sitting in an interdisciplinary team meeting, people tend to pay attention to me because I can frame things in ways that make sense to them. And so I find that for me, advocacy is being able to use that skill to amplify the voices of communities and young people who are not typically heard and who are not typically seen, and being able to ensure that their needs are being met by broader systems.
I think that's a great way to end the episode. Would you like to say anything else before we end off?
No, I'm just very excited to have been here and been a part of it, and I look forward to continuing these conversations.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your time. I know you're busy. your right to speak will be posted on the second Wednesday of every month. Thank you again. It was a great conversation. If you're a child or youth that would like to be on the show, or if you have an idea of what topic you think we should be talking about, you can please email me or Jen at yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. That's yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. Let's raise awareness together.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.